Good morning. Welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft, is at the controls this morning. While American banks and investment companies were the first to be hurt by the current financial crisis, they were soon joined by institutions around the world with profound effects on the economies of many countries. This morning in this part of Focus 580, we'll try to talk a little bit about what governments in Britain, Europe, and Asia are doing to try to cope with what has become truly an international problem. And our guest is Adam Posen. He is a widely cited expert on monetary policy. He is the deputy director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C., where he has been a senior fellow since 1997. He's been a visiting scholar at central banks worldwide, including on many occasions at the Federal Reserve Board, the European Central Bank, and the Deutsche Bundesbank. He's also been a consultant to several U.S. government agencies, including Departments of State, Treasury, and the Council on Economic Advisers. He's also been consultant to the European Commission and the Japanese Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, and to the International Monetary Fund. He's a frequent contributor to the opinion page of the Financial Times. He's also published in a number of leading papers around the world, and he's joining us from Washington. Questions, of course, are welcome. The only thing we ask of callers is that people just try to be brief, so we can keep moving along, get in as many people as possible, but certainly callers are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if you are listening over the air around Illinois and Indiana, or you might be listening on the internet across the country, either way, you certainly may use that toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. So at any point here, you're certainly welcome to call. Mr. Posen, hello.
Hi, that's a very nice long bio. Let's get past my bio.
I was trying to keep it brief because your experience is quite broad. So, I thank you very much for being with us.
No, thank you for having me, David.
What we're talking about here certainly began. It seemed to begin as an American crisis with the collapse of housing values and the subprime lending market, and the consequences for borrowers, for lenders, for investors who put money into securities that were backed by what we now know were bad mortgages. So perhaps maybe we'd start out by just asking a very basic question. How is it that this thing that began as a very American crisis very quickly became an international crisis?
There are several reasons. I mean, the first is the U.S. is the world's largest economy, and the rest of the world is very interconnected with us. They sell a lot of stuff to us. They invest things here and vice versa. So that's a direct effect. A second thing is that financial markets in particular are interconnected. The major money center banks tend to interact with each other. So it may not be just Citigroup and JP Morgan Chase in the US. It can be Royal Bank of Scotland in London. It can be UBS in Zurich. It can be Mitsubishi Tokyo Bank in Tokyo. They're all busy lending to each other. But the third point that I think doesn't quite get as much attention as it should is, while I think there were profound policy failures in the US, there were a number of other countries that had big real estate booms and now busts, and that did have bad banking behavior beyond the U.S., and that includes most of Western Europe.
Mm. So that's that was one of the things that I certainly wanted to try to take up, that, as you say, I'm sure people understand that we have a globalized economy, so anything that happens in this country, if it's this dramatic, is going to be felt elsewhere. But it's also the case that some of the same sorts of problems that we saw here in the United States, we also saw in other countries. So as in a sense, homegrown problems.
There's a mix because there are places like Germany, for example, did not have a big real estate run up the way we did and some other countries did. But their people did buy, meaning both their households and their banks, did buy a lot of assets from the U.S. that turned out to be toxic. Mm-hmm. They didn't buy them from the U.S. government. They bought them from U.S. businesses. And to some degree, they still blame the U.S. for it. But then you've got other places like Spain and Britain and Portugal where they really did have huge real estate booms on a scale as big as ours, in fact, or if not bigger. And they just ran into trouble. And for people like me who work on the policy aspects, it's a little confusing because Spain, for example, seem to have a much better system of regulation, frankly, than the U.S. did in the last few years, but yet they're getting into some of the same problems.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is something that I think the leaders of Britain and Europe, as they're getting together to try to come up with a unified approach to dealing with this problem, this is something that seems they seem intent on talking about, and that is addressing regulation in Britain and in Europe. And seem to feel that there are issues that they need to deal with there. What sort of things are they talking about? And how would one compare the regulatory atmosphere in, say, Britain and Europe with the United States as far as it came to banking?
Well, you're very well informed that that is their emphasis. And if you look at this past weekend, the G7, the major industrial economies, met, and their communique, which came out, Secretary Paulson made a very big deal. Our Treasury Secretary made a very big deal out of the fact that it was much more concise and pointed than usual, and it was. But it included a paragraph saying we have to work together on implementing a set of regulatory steps. And the kinds of things they're talking about are, frankly, things that we should also be considering here, especially since there is one global banking market. It includes not letting the ratings agencies substitute for regulators making sure that the bank's books are good. It includes making sure banks keep on hand enough capital. They don't get to pretend that some of the things they invested in were off balance sheet, meaning they didn't have to provision capital against it. It includes making sure that these banks also have liquidity on hand. That is to say, they have enough cash on hand rather than assuming they can go get it when they need it. Another point is consumer protection on mortgages and on various types of securities like derivatives. That's actually been a bigger issue for the U.S. than in other countries. We've done a less good job of protecting consumers, particularly on mortgages.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a list of things that are pretty sensible. There's also some very technical issues having to do with these things called credit default swaps and other things called derivatives, which are contracts relating to underlying securities. And it's basically about bringing them out into the light of day and making it easier to understand what the prices are.
Now, apparently, what these governments have agreed to do, I don't know if they have officially and formally agreed to it, but we've got a plan where what they're planning on doing in a very maybe oversimplified sort of way is what they're planning on doing is putting a great deal of money into their banks. We're talking about, and it's a truly stunning figure if you add up what all the European governments and Scandinavian governments and Britain are talking about, you get a figure at something like 2 trillion euro. The British alone are talking about 500 billion pounds. So that's a lot of money. The thing I think is interesting here is that the United States initially was talking about doing something different. They were talking about buying up bad loans. And now it seems that the United States is talking about doing what the Europeans are talking about doing. Can you talk just a little bit about the strategy that the Europeans seem to have agreed on?
Well, just one factual point. The $2 trillion, or 2 trillion euro, therefore, much more than that in dollars number you were talking about, isn't all going to go directly into the bank. Some of it is loan guarantees. So it's at risk for the public, but it's not actual expenditure. But more broadly speaking, what happened was the Europeans are a little more experienced with this stuff than we are, or at least they were more willing to pay attention to experience. And the British government, which is part of the EU but not part of the Eurozone, showed some real leadership and stood up and said, well, we've got to put capital directly into the banks. And there are trade-offs to doing that, but essentially that's what everyone agrees is how you deal with things when you've got a really bad banking problem. That's the only way to keep banks from making additional bad loans. That's the only way to keep banks seen as trustworthy by other people. And you usually get the money back, usually at a profit, not always, but usually. And so the British came out with that plan going into last weekend, and the Europeans initially were quite disinclined to follow it. And then they turned around and by the end of the weekend had gone home to Europe. I was supposed to meet with an official from the European Central Bank, and he or she had taken off on Sunday because they had to be back for the European meeting, and they followed the British principle. What happened in the U.S. was essentially what I understand is that the Fed and a lot of other outside people were urging the U.S. to do this a while ago, and Secretary Paulson and the Bush administration were opposed. They had an ideological blinder that it would be better not to have the public involved. It's the usual distrust of government that they pursue. Now, I agree that we don't want a government running our banking system, making individual loan decisions and things like that. But there's very ample precedent for the government getting involved with this kind of cleanup, with taking a temporary stake in banks. Mm-hmm. And they were just being unduly resistant to that.
Do you think that the European decision to make this very significant capital infusion into their banks influenced the decision of the United States to follow the same path?
Absolutely. There was people often talking globalization about a race to the bottom, that you're always going to have whoever has the lowest standards wins. Well, in this case, we actually had a race to the top. First, the Irish and then the British came out with major increases in their deposit insurance, the Germans too, and then everybody else had to match it, because otherwise everybody would say, why am I in a bad bank with less insurance than one that has good insurance? And then the same thing happened with the capital. Once the British moved and then the Europeans got convinced, the major American banks are sitting there saying, oh my God, they've got government-guaranteed capital, they've got much more trust from the markets, we're going to be at a huge competitive disadvantage. And I think that was what finally pressed Paulson. And I think this is a general point about globalization, that on some cases you don't have a competition to the bottom in regulation. You sometimes have a competition towards the top.
Hmm. Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Adam Posen. He is the deputy director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. He is a widely cited expert on monetary policy. And we're talking here about the monetary crisis, the financial crisis has hit the United States very hard, and what that's meant for the rest of the world. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Forgive me, Mr. Posen. Apparently, we have some people who are listening to the program who say they're having a little difficulty hearing you and understanding you, and my technical people are asking me if I could ask you to get in a little closer to the microphone.
Okay, my lips are pretty much against it, but I'm not enunciating.
Okay.
So I'll try to project in best fashion.
I think it wasn't a matter so much of enunciating, I think, as it was just on general volume level. Okay, well, in that case, maybe people are also going to have to turn up their radios a little bit. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we do have a caller to talk with, someone here in Urbana, where we are. This is line one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How are you? Over the years, I've called this program to talk to economists who've come on, or not banking officials like you, and I've always wondered why there seemed to be like a euphoria about the growth in housing, and not really realizing that, you know, the collapse of the NASDAQ in 2000 plus the collapse of the LTCM, you know, long-term capital management in 98, sort of had an indication that there was something fundamentally flawed in the methodology that people were using. And now it's come to this, and I agree with you, this unified response by the Federal Reserve and the central banks of Europe and Asia is very important, because the psychology of markets is important, in that people have basically, I mean, I'm not worried about, you know, the banks failing per se, though there probably was something close to that about a week ago. And I'm not sure stock markets are indicative of actual economic health anymore. I think they're sort of a sideshow, more of a, you know, get-rich-quick schemes and stuff like that. But I was wondering if there is some indication that there needs to be a complete reevaluation of the regulatory system, and will that happen, or will people become complacent again? Because this is definitely a complacency problem. If you go back to the Federal Reserve, about 3 years ago, had a paper that they had commissioned on the LTCM collapse. For some reason, I may be the only person that read it. It seemed to indicate that there was a flaw in the regulatory system that allowed these offshore accounts to you know, derivative-driven, I call it fake paper, where you fabricate ideas and you use the complex algorithms and stuff like that to develop these marketing strategies to sell basically air. I mean, basically it's like not a Ponzi scheme per se, but it's basically, I mean, it's just, it seems to me like that it seemed obvious from the LTCM paper that there was a lot of, like, lack of transparency, and no one asked for it. Nobody asked for, like, what are you selling me or whatever. And it seems to have turned out to be, like, one giant lie. And I don't know what you think about that.
Well, I think you've painted the economic landscape actually pretty well in the sense that there is this distinction between what goes on in the stock markets and what goes on in the real economy, at least over short periods of time, that there is a distinction between the panic we've seen over the last few weeks, which is a very serious matter, and then the sales of these bad assets over the last few years. And I think in particular, I agree with you that the fundamental failing that got us into this mess was a lack of supervision and regulation from the U.S. government. But what's interesting about it is that a lot of it is, as we've seen in other areas like foreign policy in the U.S., there's an excessive amount of discretion left up to the federal, left to the executive branch, I should say, of the government. And so, in a sense, one doesn't want Congress to have to be the watchdog, but in a sense, they let us down too. For several years, the Federal Reserve was not doing a good job of enforcing the rules we all knew were out there on mortgages. The Community Reinvestment Act, but other rules forced the Fed to be the protector of consumers. The Fed didn't really want the responsibility, and so they and some of the people, including especially under Greenspan, ideologically didn't want to enforce it. They thought expanding home ownership was their big goal, and so they didn't do it. And you talk about Fed papers. There's a man who was on the board of governors of the Federal Reserve, Ned Gramlich, a very distinguished public servant. He died recently, but before he died, about 2 years ago, he wrote a paper documenting all the ways in which the Fed let us down in the mortgage market. There was also a very good article, I think it was by Peter Goodman, in the New York Times within the last week, documenting how not just Greenspan, but also people in the Clinton Treasury, you know, bullied anybody who tried to constrain the growth of derivatives. The one place I would differ a little is the idea that they were just selling air. If they were just selling air, it actually would have been less damaging. There would have been fewer counterparties. There would have been less real damage to the economy. What I think did happen is that there was a legitimate aspect of financial innovation, but people took it too much on faith, you know, and financial innovation should be like agricultural innovation or aeronautics innovation or pick a different letter in the alphabet. But, you know, not every innovation you do turns out to work well when you put it into practice. And some of these derivatives were legitimate attempts at financial engineering, and it turned out ex post that they didn't work very well. But I think we did too little safety inspections the way we would, say, on GMO crops or the way we would, say, on airplanes versus on these new financial instruments.
So do you think that this really precipice? I mean, I was watching this last week or 2 weeks ago thinking, this is really bad. I mean, they better do something fast. Do you think that there will be substantive regulation out of this? I'm talking about internationally. Mm-hmm. I know you're right about the Europeans. From what I gather from listening to and reading the French press and the English press, et cetera, they seem to be a little more more watchdog-like. Do you think they will be, like, good stuff will come out of this? I mean, is that what your agenda is now?
My personal agenda is that, and I think the European officials' agenda is that, and I'm glad you followed up because I meant to respond to your raising that. I think it's very important. I am hopeful that with a new administration in office, as well as the humility that some American officials and financiers should take at this point, that the Europeans will be pushing on a relatively open door. I mean, there are still going to be people out there insisting, oh, if you have too much regulation, you'll kill the golden goose. I think we can go a very long way from where we are now without killing that golden goose. And as I tried to say to David before your call, there's a pretty clear agenda. I mean, not all of it sounds that sexy. Some of it sounds pretty technical. But there's a pretty clear agenda about basically making it so that things are more transparent. Banks cannot leverage themselves as much as they used to, so they can't get into as much trouble. And that the bank supervisors actually have to pay attention to what's going on rather than letting the banks tell them what's going on.
Yeah.
And I think that general thrust is something we're going to see. I'm hopeful.
I'm wondering how they're going to do that, not make it political. I mean, you know, because that's what you were saying earlier, and I agree with you about the fact that the politics of this, like the Clinton administration, everybody's saying, oh, just leave this alone, let the market do the work, which, of course, the market has ostensibly failed miserably. But I want to thank you for your work, and I really agree with you, and thanks, David, for letting me say it.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you.
Well, we have some other callers. They're both in Champaign, and the next in line is line number two, right here. Hello. Is there a caller there? Line two, go ahead.
Yes. Could you tell me whether this financial crisis will affect the financial mathematics, which you know, branches of mathematics concerning with finance, or were they, or were those studying of derivatives and like that, was that relevant to this crisis, or whether it was has nothing to do with the actual mathematics, or whether it was just the
I think there's two pieces to it. As many of your listeners are now aware, there were literally rocket scientists, people with physics PhDs, who were being hired by these financial firms to construct instruments. And really what they were trying to do was try to figure out how to price them. And I think the failure to price them well and have a liquid market for them in recent months, which meant no one could get their money out, is going to lead to two changes about the mathematics. The first is, there's going to be more of a duty on senior bank officials that even if they don't understand what the math is, they have to be accountable for it. And so there was this tendency even for, you know, heads of Citigroup and heads of Goldman Sachs, let alone firms that messed up much worse, to say, oh, well, that's what the rocket scientists do and I don't really understand it. Well, that's not going to be an excuse anymore. At least one hopes not. And the second thing is particularly on the math. A lot of the math, I mean, this is the Champaign-Urbana station, so probably there are a bunch of engineers who understand this better than I do. But a lot of the math was based on the idea that events occur along pretty much a normal distribution. So there are events in the tails, the rare events, they only happen once in a long while. Instead, one could argue, well, there are a lot of what they call Six Sigma events, meaning things six standard deviations, very extreme events compared to what you see on average. And you now have to redo these models based on that assumption. And if you do that, a lot of these things look a lot less attractive. There was, I guess, a bestseller called The Black Swan that came out within the last year or so, which sort of gets into this idea. But on a technical sense, it's really going to be about them reassessing what's the distribution of risk.
So you're saying that they dismissed improbable events, and that's why they didn't take account of their assumptions that sort of improbable events would take place, which turned out to be not that improbable.
Yeah, and that's essentially what got LTCM 10 years ago, long-term capital management. That's what got a lot of people here. Essentially, you're making two bets in a technical sense. You're making one, a bet on what's called mean reversion, the idea that the value of things may fluctuate in financial markets, but there's some basic fundamental value that they come back to within a reasonable amount of time, even if the fundamental value changes over time. And the second thing is that the distribution of those fluctuations is relatively well-behaved. It's like we've all talked about the bell curve that you used to get, you know, in school for, or maybe they don't do that anymore. But anyway, there's a lot of things that occur tend to occur around the averages, and very few things tend to occur at the extremes. Well, those two assumptions are now in question. Do securities really mean revert, really go back to their fundamentals within a finite length of time? Well, finite in human lifetimes, yes. Finite in market time, probably not.
I would say rule out chaos theory, if they...
Well, I'm, you know, as in physics and in biology, I mean, I'm sure there's some very clever people out there who are trying to do this stuff with chaos theory. As somebody in the practical side, I've yet to see anything from that particular avenue turn out to be terribly useful, except as just a cautionary thing that maybe assuming things stay very stable is not a good assumption.
Obviously. Thank you.
All right, thank you. It seems to me, Mr. Poston, speaking as someone who is not a rocket scientist or a physicist, that the big problem here was the assumption that was the fact that people ignored that, well, things go up and then they go down. There seemed to be this assumption that as far as the value of real estate and everything that was staked on that, that it would never go down. It would simply continue to, that bubble would simply continue to grow and grow. And no one seemed to take very – well, someone did. Some people did. But yeah, it seemed there were a lot of people who weren't even taking seriously the very notion that one day the bubble would burst.
Yeah, but I guess the complication I want to offer – I think you're right about that, David, and we all felt that, right? You know, oh, that guy next door has a house that's much bigger than mine, and why the hell was he able to take that home equity loan, and why shouldn't I do that? And you know, but and also just the folk wisdom that land never goes down in value, which is false but was widely believed. But the complication I want to offer is you can have different shocks to financial markets, and they don't necessarily all have the same impact on the economy. So we had the IT bubble, which in popular sense and investor spirit was very similar to the real estate bubble. People just believed it could keep going up, no risk of it going down, or at least it wasn't going to go down before they got out. And that clearly is part of the story. But the IT bubble really did much less damage to the economy and to the financial system than this current real estate bubble did. And that's why some of these other things about what the banks were allowed to do, how complicated were their transactions, how transparent were they, start to kick in. So, yes, we would have had probably a real estate bubble, I wouldn't say no matter what, but it probably had very little to do with these things. But the impact of that bubble is made worse by these financial failures.
Mm-hmm. All right. We'll talk next with someone in Champaign, and this is line 3. Hello.
Yes, hi. I don't know if this is too far off the topic or not, but it seems like so much of our economy is driven on the idea of infinite resources and the need for growth and consumerism, which is kind of, I mean, in part what happened as far as, you know, wanting to push the whole building and housing market and the whole growth that it was giving to the economy. And I just wondered, is this not like a kind of a fundamental economic flaw? And are there other economic models that countries or communities can adopt that aren't so totally based on growth and consumerism? Because it seems like there cannot be infinite growth since there are finite resources. And that, you know, maybe it's time to start looking at other ways of developing a strong economy, not entirely based on a constant need for more and more and more and consuming. So I don't know if that fits, how this fits in, but yeah. If you can.
Well, it is a serious topic of debate, both in economic research and particularly in Europe. There's been a lot of discussion about whether there is this American obsession with growth and whether some Europeans have a better model by not being so obsessed with it. This is one place, though, where I do have to sound a little more free market and a little more pro-American. I do research in this area, and I've become convinced, and I think the bulk of economists have become convinced, although they wouldn't necessarily put it this way, that it's not so much that growth is an end unto itself. It's that an economy that doesn't grow has something very wrong with it. If you think about an economy in a sense as analogous to a child or a teenager, you know, that it's an organic system. It sort of goes and if it's well-fed and behaving well and in a good environment, it will naturally grow. And the reason that's the case in the U.S. or in Europe or any place, even with limited resources, is because human innovation takes place. Human innovation in all senses. So, I mean, new technologies, leave aside the financial innovation, IT technologies. Innovations in human organization, that we run organizations better than we used to. Innovations in culture, that, you know, there are enough TV programs out there to fill the 100 channels on my cable set. all these kinds of innovations occur naturally. It's just like the cells in your son or daughter's body, you know, splitting and growing and developing. That happens naturally, and that should lead to growth irrespective of what your basic resources are. And that's not a choice. What ends up being a choice is how much you interfere with that process. And so I'm sorry if this is sounding too abstract, but in the end, a country that doesn't grow has something wrong with it. The extreme case would be a country like Zimbabwe, where the government has created so much terror and so much uncertainty about property and uncertainty about people's lives, and the health of the people are in such bad shape, and the rule of law is very uncertain, and nobody saves anything because there's such high inflation. You know, that's why they don't grow. But more importantly and relevantly for what you were raising, you know, it's not like we can sort of calibrate it that, oh, well, maybe the Swiss or the French have a better idea, you know, if they only grow at 1% a year, but there's less consumption and things are a little less frantic. That's not, in the end, really how it works. There are things you can do about the distribution of income, about the nature of work. The U.S. could well benefit from a discussion and debate about that. But the fundamental idea of taking on growth, I frankly believe, is not the way to go.
Okay. Do you think consumerism is linked to growth or not necessarily?
Not necessarily. Consumerism and growth are not the same thing. You can have growth that is without huge amounts of consumerism. You can have consumerism without huge amounts of growth. I do believe that societies that deprive their consumers of their, meaning their individuals, their households, of the right to buy stuff as warily as they can end up hurting the people. But that doesn't mean that every single thing that promotes, you know, megamart consumption is the best thing in the world.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We are a bit past our midpoint here, and we have other calls. And let me just very quickly, again, introduce our guest, Adam Posen. He's Deputy Director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. This is, as they describe themselves, a private, nonprofit, nonpartisan research institution interested in the study of international economic policy. He is a widely cited expert on monetary policy. He's been visiting scholar at central banks around the world. He's also been a consultant to several U.S. government agencies, including Department of Treasury and the Council of Economic Advisors. We're talking about the international implications of this current financial crisis that we're experiencing and how, particularly how governments in Britain and Europe outside of the United States are responding. And questions are welcome. And the lines are full. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll go to someone on a cell phone near Lovington. This is line number one. Hello.
Hi. David, you just gave that description. I realize my question is so far off base, I almost hesitate to ask it, but I'm still here. So.
Okay, well, go ahead.
Some of these new homes that have been built, you said that people weren't buying air. 30-year mortgage, and I believe there's an expert that used to be at the U of I, and David can correct me if I'm wrong, that said some of the major building materials in these homes will only last 30 years. So I guess I kind of wonder if they weren't buying air, if maybe that had anything at all to do with anything that happened with maybe the confidence in these mortgages and what they were based on, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Well, I got to admit, I'm not a real estate economist or even a real estate investor, so I don't really know. My sense is that any skimping on building materials or poor construction may be real, but that wasn't what was driving the financial markets. Mm-hmm. Most financial market people aren't too clever about building things any more than me.
Well, maybe another way to look at it would be to ask a question something like this. Do you think that that there were too many people who were looking at housing purely as an investment and not as a place where they were going to live and perhaps live there for some extended period of time?
Well, I think that's a good way to put it. The emphasis on housing ownership in the U.S. has always been a little bit odd and a little bit extreme. I don't mean that we have more people owning houses here than in other countries. In fact, there are a number of other countries like Britain and Ireland where, you know, as opposed to the U.S. where we have in somewhere in the high 60% range as homeowners, they have 70 or 80%. What I mean is there are all kinds of distortions in the tax code and all kinds of myths out there that people are somehow fundamentally better off if they own their home. For most people, it's really just a slightly better alternative to renting, and it's only better alternative to renting if you are staying put for several years. So it's worth questioning that. But the one point where I guess I would talk about the most recent real estate run-up is I think it was something different because it was more about people thinking, oh, I'm going to get a big appreciation in the next couple years. Oh, I can flip this, or oh, I can take out more debt because it's going to keep going up. And I think that was something very different.
Yeah. Just let me ask you, and I'll get back to the phones here in a moment, but I'm interested in this question. Here in the United States, I think a lot of people got pretty exercised about the idea of the government being involved in the economy to the extent that it now is or will be. In Europe, in countries where perhaps there's not quite, people don't get quite so exercised about that, was that though, was there any difficulty in getting these governments to come together and agree on this plan that apparently they have agreed on?
Oh, there certainly was difficulty. The Germans, as is their usual wont, were very concerned about excessive government activism. They believe in a state role in the economy, but they don't like seeing government get busy with it. Mm-hmm. They also were worried about being left with the bill for others' mistakes. The British, as usual, were having to cope with the fact that they take their financial system very seriously. It's a huge share of their GDP, of their national economy, and part of their identity, frankly, in recent decades. And so there was some stuff to be overcome there. The Scandinavians actually went through terrible banking crises 15 years ago, and this time through they've barely been touched. I mean, that Iceland aside. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of disagreement. And there was also a fundamental suspicion about Europe that these are all separate nation states. You know, in the U.S., if the people at the Federal Reserve get together, you know, and there's somebody from the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago representing one district and somebody from Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City representing another district, we don't tend to think of them really fighting on a regional basis. We do tend to think of, oh, the French may have a different interest than the Italians, who may have a different interest than the Spanish. Mm. But Europe, meaning the institutions and the decision makers, surprised us all on the positive side. They saw the crisis, they agreed on a course of action, and they moved quickly. And I think a lot of Americans who've been skeptical about European decision making have to be aware that when push came to shove, the Europeans did a good job.
I think it strikes me as interesting, or it seems like maybe it is interesting, that the British really took a leadership position here. And I think about the fact that Gordon Brown has had such a rough ride uh-huh. since he's become prime minister, that in fact his position on this and the British leadership on this might at the very least be good for Gordon Brown. Is it surprising at all that in fact the rest of Europe seems to be on this following the British lead?
It's not hugely surprising, but it is to Gordon Brown's credit. As we say in baseball, I mean, this really was in his wheelhouse. You know, this is the kind of economic work that he and his staff really understand, and they had the right vision pretty quickly. I want to give credit to the Central Europeans, that the other governments, that they didn't get peeved against a good idea just because it was coming from the British, because the British, you know, always are, including under Gordon Brown, are very skeptical of European integration, and they don't do as much to bring along their European neighbors as they should. There's all kinds of rumors about Gordon Brown not even really informing some of the fellow European governments about his plan before he announced it, you know, which is just not good form, frankly. And so there's a level of maturity on the part of European policymakers that they were able to get past that. I guess I should leave it there. I mean, I think Gordon Brown comes out of this looking very good, as Paul Krugman noted in the New York Times the other day.
All right. Well, let's talk with some other folks. Next up is Champagne in line two. Hello.
Good morning. You mentioned Paul Krugman. I wonder if you happened to have seen him last Sunday.
I... I haven't seen him personally in a while, but no, sorry. You mean his last article?
No, actually, I was thinking of his television appearance. But you mentioned that in that appearance about he thought the financial community was sort of the victim of a collective mindset or captured mindset.
Mm-hmm.
In any, with respect, I suppose, to derivatives and these financial instruments. My question is, to what extent do you think this can be attributed to self-delusion, or like, or what category do you put this current crisis fiasco in? Was it a matter of the self-delusion of the higher echelons of banking community, or was it greed, or, you know, did some people at least know what's going on? Krugman seemed to have an idea, and then went along for the ride. That's my thought. What's your thought?
Well, first off, to say, if you're going to read one economist, the person to read is Paul Krugman. He deserved the Nobel Prize for nothing to do with his columnists, and he's great. And that column in particular, that thought which he said on TV, which I've seen elsewhere from him, I think is the right idea, that people do become captives of their mindset. So when we hear about Henry Paulson, you know, having Goldman Sachs in at meetings, I don't think he has any conflict of interest. I mean, I know at this point he genuinely doesn't get any personal benefit out of that. He just has this mindset that we need the best market people at this meeting, and that's a skill you need, and those are the best people. And so then when you sort of take that out more largely to what went on, I do think for a lot of people in the business, particularly at the higher levels of the banks, there was just this mindset, oh, we've hired the best and the brightest, and we should just trust them and go ahead with it. And of course, it seems to be working. But, and here's a big but, there are a lot of subcomponents where there was outright fraud. I mean, a lot of the stuff done by mortgage brokers was just plain wrong. A lot of the derivatives sold by specific salespeople to unsuspecting people, particularly in Europe, frankly, was just plain wrong. So it's both. And again, my experience with the people at the tops of some of these financial firms is I think they were more victims of their mindset. They're responsible. I mean, they took home huge salaries. They were in charge. They should have done more due diligence. And so they are accountable. But I don't view them as actively promoting fraud. There are people in the system, though, who did, and that would be another thing to keep track of.
Should I follow up or not?
Well, I'm very short on time and have other callers. I hope you won't mind. I beg the caller's indulgence and want to go on. Let's go to line three. This is a Champagne. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Actually, raised an interesting. Why was the, in terms of Scandinavian countries, sort of miss this, you know, in terms of this debacle. Was it that they also invested in their own countries, that kind of thing, the social system? The other one is that what would be the parallels with the that we had with the savings and loan, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'll just go off the air.
All right.
Well, thank you for that. On the second question first, I think the parallels with the savings and loan are really important. Part of the reason people like me and many others were able to stand up and say, we do have to inject capital into the banks at this point. We do have to put conditions on it. We do have to keep going with mark-to-market accounting so we know what the real state of affairs are. Most of those things were things we learned from the savings and loan crisis and mistakes the U.S. made 25 years ago. And so, and how we got out of it. So I think the parallels there are actually quite good. And similarly, then you had other forms of financial innovation that were going on that, again, were a combination of some people genuinely believing it, some people just sort of not paying attention, and some people engaged in fraud. So I think the lesson is very apt, and that's part of the reason people like me can say with some confidence, at least, what we think should be done. The Scandinavian question is a really interesting one, too. Part of it is, again, building on the savings and loan crisis, they had terrible banking crises around 1992, the Finnish in particular, but also the Swedes. And they learned some of the right lessons. So they had much tighter banking supervision. They didn't engage in these kinds of behavior on the mortgage market. They didn't indulge in some of these things and calling them off balance sheet. So that's part of the story. But part of it is we don't know the full story yet, to be frank. The Swedish banks, for example, have been extremely active in lending to Eastern Europe, to the new members of the European Union, places like Hungary and Latvia. And those countries are now looking like they may be in quite a bit of trouble. And it will remain to be seen how much the Swedish banks suffer and how the government reacts when those countries get into trouble. So unfortunately, there are many ways to get yourself into trouble in this life. And I think the Scandinavians, in this case, avoided some of the worst of it because they learned from past bad experience. But they're not fully out of it yet.
Right. About 5-6 minutes left in this part of Focus. Just real quick, again, our guest is Adam Posen. He's deputy director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C., where he's been senior fellow since 1997. And we're talking about the international response to the current financial crisis. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Next, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I think the archetypal selling of error is selling a credit default swap, say, for General Motors, so without having any capital to back it up. That seems like that's a definition of error. And there's so much of that, and so much of it is traded back and forth, that it seems to me the derivative, or at least that part of the derivative market, ought to just be somehow folded up and throw the persons that thought of it as a good idea, and perhaps seeing if there is a criminal allegation. It seems to me that one of the things that liberated this was this bill a while back that gets repeated every now and again. It's sort of the brainchild of Phil Graham. But one of the things that apparently isn't getting much noted is that it actually allowed that the oil futures are actually traded by a rather... Even something as basic as oil is not very transparent in that it's sort of a creature of the two banks that are still standing, the two major banks that are still standing, and that they're sort of oil companies on their own because they have so much direct ownership in oil fields and pipelines and companies. I think a less commented part of the story that ought to get more comment. And I'm sorry I didn't get on sooner.
Well, no. Let me talk to you a little bit about the derivatives market and the reforms, and I'll try to be brief since we're getting close to the end. In terms of air, I mean, you can come up with some incredible stories. So there is somebody's been selling credit default swaps, and I think it was Ecuadorian debt. And the number of credit default swaps and Ecuadorian debt outstanding was something like 50 times the total value of Ecuadorian debt. So, you know, there were some really stupid things being done that should have been observed. And the biggest thing that's being pushed for on this to resolve this is that with the Federal Reserve Bank of New York in the lead, they're trying to set up two things. First, they're trying to set up a clearinghouse that will allow people to sort of X out, you know, this person has a stake on one side of the transaction, this person has a stake on the other side of the transaction, let's move them together and cancel it out and to clean up some of the mess. The second thing going forward is to try to make it so derivatives are more like normal securities, that they'd be traded in actual markets, and they'd be more plain vanilla. I wrote a column about a year ago when this first started breaking, comparing some of these derivatives to MTV's Pimp My Ride. You know, you don't really, if you build a green hatchback with a revolving soda machine for a particular person, you don't really expect that to be sold to anybody else. Similarly, you build a derivative that's very specific to, you know, Archer Daniel Midland's needs this thing on 3/4-inch soybeans in June. You don't really expect it to be sold to anybody else. And so there's going to be some pressure to move it, to make it more liquid by making it more standard. And those, I think, are constructive things. In terms of the oil market, just quickly, as we've seen with the huge movement downward in oil prices as the news got worse, despite everyone understandably getting very worried about manipulation in the oil market, there really doesn't seem to be that much. I mean, occasionally OPEC gets it together and in a very visible way asserts its control, and that's something to worry about. But the actual futures market, spot market as well for oil, seems to work pretty well. That's part of the reason it moves so much.
All right. We are just about the point we have to finish. I'm sorry, we have some callers we can't take. Just as a way to finish up, if we're not in recession now, are we looking next year at a recession worldwide?
I'm I'm still on the more optimistic side. Now that they've managed to stop the outright financial panic, I think the basic strengths of the U.S. and most of the world economy will come back. I don't want to sound like Phil Graham. There's going to be a lot of suffering en route, and we're probably going to have some bad quarters. But I think the U.S. will probably return to positive growth by the second half of 2009. And I think most of the world, the IMF is calling for what they call a global recession, meaning the emerging markets slow quite a bit. I don't think it's going to be as bad as people currently now think it is. We're going to have a rough 2009, but I think we're going to be okay.
And just here in the short term, the United States and Europeans apparently agreed on a small cut in interest rates, only half a percentage point. I think there are some people who say there's going to have to be much, much deeper cut in interest rates. Some people have said as close as we get them to zero, that's what we should do. Will we see more and more dramatic cuts in interest rates?
I don't think so much from the Fed. Right now, the Fed and most of these other central banks have provided so much liquidity to the markets, and the ability to borrow is so cheap that that's really not the issue anymore. I think the baton has been legitimately passed to the fiscal authorities, meaning the U.S. Treasury, the finance ministries, in terms of whether there are tax cuts, whether there are stimulus packages, whether you put more money in the banking system. I mean, it wouldn't shock me if the Fed cut rates once more, and I expect some foreign central banks that had much higher interest rates than the Fed, like the European Central Bank, to cut pretty aggressively. But really, the action now moves from the monetary authority to the fiscal authority.
Our guest is Adam Posen. He is the deputy director of the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington, D.C. They have a website if you're interested in finding out what they're all about. You can go there and check it out. And Mr. Posen, to you, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for reminding people of our website. We look forward to seeing them there.